Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
As a theologian, I have a love-hate relationship with metaphors. We need them, this is clear, especially to do theology, but metaphors take on a life of their own. We forget that they're only tools. We tend to reify them beyond what their original use can bear. Metaphors change, and a metaphor helpful in one age can be confusing in another. And so any serious effort then to think critically about what our Lord has revealed to us requires a meticulous analysis of the metaphors that we use. In this lecture, I want to trace one very common metaphor that runs through the entire Christian tradition, the metaphor that likens the relationship between church and state to that of soul and body. As the image goes, as the soul is to the body, therefore the church is to the state. And I wish to do three things. Three parts to this lecture. Part one, I will uncover the conditions of the ancient world that provided the fruitful soil for this metaphor to take root, why it was an attractive option, and what did it mean when it first entered the Christian repertoire of images describing her relationship to the world. Second, I will show how and why this metaphor slowly changed through time, as all images do. And third, I will demonstrate how modern Catholic social thought, inaugurated particularly by Pope Leo XIII, purifies this metaphor by reviving a robust social ontology rooted in Catholic thought, rooted in classical thought, and a deeper ecclesiology that sees the church as a true supernatural society ordered to the perfection of its members. I hope in this way to establish a vision of the church as a societas perfecta, a perfect society, established by grace, ordered to the supernatural beatitude of her citizens, and equipped by God with all the requisite means necessary to bring her children to perfection. Part one. Christianity did not emerge in a vacuum. When our Lord Jesus descended from heaven and assumed a human nature, that humanity came prepackaged, so to speak, with a context and a history. Jesus established his church within a social and political world laden with its own presuppositions. The ancient thinkers and philosophers, particularly those of Greece and Rome, Aristotle and Cicero being my main sources, understood that the human person was a rational animal. And as a rational animal, the human person is a social animal, a political animal, a zoon politikon. It's who we are. The human person by nature inhabits a society, or a polis, comes to his perfection through the interpersonal bonds that form among citizens within a community. The human person is ordered towards the other in a communion called a society. And this sociality renders the human person perfectible by a uniquely other-directed natural virtue that transcends the mere animal and the material. And this is the virtue of justice. Justice is the constant and perpetual will to render the other what is his due. This other directedness establishes bonds between people and holds society together as something more than a mere collection of animals in a herd. These bonds of justice establish a whole of order known to philosophy as a common good. A good of order equally shared by all, uniting all who share it into one. Without a common good, there is no society. And without justice, there is no common good. This is why Cicero claimed, ubi societas, ibi jus. Wherever there is society, there is justice. Now, one feature of justice lost to most contemporary thinkers, unfortunately, but certainly not lost to classical thinkers, is this. The highest instance of justice exists in offering what is due not just to anyone, but to the highest object. It is higher to offer what is due to one's parents than to one's equals. It is higher still to offer what is due to one's rulers. The highest instance of natural justice then consists in offering what is due to God. God. That's natural justice. And this part of justice, the highest part of justice, which renders what is due to God, is called natural religion. It's the highest natural virtue. Of course, Aquinas would call it the highest virtue instance of justice, natural religion. In the ancient pagan world, each city was held together by a natural religion that offered the city's god their due worship and honor. In the ancient pagan world, acts of religion were not private affairs, but acts of civic duty. Each member of the pagan city, by virtue of membership in the polis, was required to serve the common good by worshiping the city's gods. And failure to worship the city's gods was no private vice. It was an act of civil disobedience. It was public. An attack on the very fabric of justice that held the city together. An attack on the heart and soul of the common good. The conclusion is simple, that for the pagan world, a union of politics and religion was the norm. It was normal. There could be no possible distinction between these two orders. There was not two orders. It doesn't make any sense. On a purely natural level, then, the integration of religion and politics is, in a certain sense, the human default position. We think that the modern world is normal. It's actually not. The union between the two, that's the default human position, actually, especially even all over the world. That's the default. Now, in the pre-Christian world, then, two groups posed a great threat to the pagan city. There were two groups. The philosophers and the Jews. They were the biggest threat. Both philosophers and Jews were a threat, not because they were irreligious, but because both professed a devotion to a universal principle that transcended the particular gods of local politics. Both bent the knee, not to a local god, but to a universal principle demanding obedience beyond particular bonds to any particular place. First, the philosophers. Socrates was executed, forced to drink the hemlock. And why? Because he refused to worship the god of Athens. It was Athena. In Delphi, they worshipped Apollo, in Samos, Hera, in Babylon, Marduk, in Olympia, Zeus. There was a statue of Zeus out here. Thought I was in Olympia again. My gosh. And I get a tour of campus. I'm like, there's a pagan god here at the campus. Unbelievable. What was that? Typical. So Socrates, in his questioning of the Athenian gods and his commitment to a higher principle of truth, left him and his followers vulnerable to the charge of civil disobedience. And he went to his death. Second, the Jews. They were a threat, again, not because they were irreligious, but because they claimed to serve the one true God above all other gods. The Lord is God, the psalmist says, the God above all the gods. He holds in his hands the depths of the earth and the highest mountains as well. So in the minds of Gentile peoples, although some Gentiles extended levels of tolerance to the Jews at certain times, the Jewish claim to the oneness of their God continually threatened their trustworthiness as loyal citizens in the pagan city. How could they be expected to be just? So, did Christianity solve this problem? No, it did not. It only amplified the dilemma. Our citizenship is in heaven, St. Paul insists, as he writes to the Philippians. Our citizenship is in heaven. To the Ephesians, he says, you are no longer strangers and sojourners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself as the capstone. Wow. Christians are not citizens of the world. So when St. Paul writes this all over the New Testament, it's actually, we don't read it the way that they read it in the first century, but it's powerful when we're not citizens of this world. It doesn't have the impact for us like it would for the first century. Right after Jesus fed the 5,000, St. John tells us that the crowd was, quote, about to come and take him by force to make him king. But what did Jesus do? He said, good, finally, you got the right king. No, what did Jesus do? He simply withdrew to a lonely place to pray. My kingdom is not of this world, he later tells Pilate. My kingdom is not of this world. The first three centuries saw countless Christians go to their martyrdom, not from the Jews, but from who? The Romans, for not worshiping gods and the emperor. Christianity was viewed as a treacherous disloyalty and threat to state stability. Now, in the midst of this persecution, we find one ancient defense of Christianity written by an unnamed author, likely a Roman Christian of the second century, perhaps during the persecution of Marcus Aurelius, scholars would assume. This is the famous Letter to Diognetus from the second century. The anonymous author pleads with his reader not to view Christians as a threat to the city simply because they do not worship its gods. And his defense, what's his defense? Christians are to the world what the soul is to the body. Ah. He writes, and I'm just going to read from paragraph 6, which I think is the second paragraph on the page. To put the matter simply, what the soul is in the body is what Christians are to the world. The soul is spread throughout all the limbs of the body. Christians are spread throughout the cities of the world. The soul lives in the body, but it does not belong to the body. Ooh, that's interesting. Ooh. Christians live in the world, but do not belong to the world. Ouch. The soul, which is invisible, is put under guard in the visible body. Christians are known to be in the world, but their worship of God remains invisible. The flesh hates the soul and attacks it, even though it has suffered no harm, because it is a hindrance from indulging in its pleasures. And the world hates the Christians, even though it has suffered no harm, because they are opposed to its pleasures. The soul loves the flesh that hates it, along with its limbs. Christians love those who hate them. The soul is imprisoned in the body, but it sustains or constrains the body. Christians are detained in the prison of the world, but they sustain or constrain the world. The soul, which is immortal, dwells in a mortal tent. Christians temporarily dwell in perishable surroundings, but await that which is imperishable in the heavens. The soul grows stronger even when mistreated by what the body eats and drinks. Christians increase daily even when punished. God has appointed them to such a position, and it would not be right for them to abandon it. Wow. So, the image of soul-body officially enters the Christian menu of images. Now let's examine this passage in detail. First, we must note that the repeated use of the gospel trope of Jesus' kingdom being in the world but not of the world signals that this source, his source is the gospel. It is not political philosophy. This is a defense of Christian faith, not a reflection on politics. The church he describes is not the soul of the Roman state. That's important. But the soul of the cosmos. The cosmos. In fact, the repeated use of cosmos instead of politeia or polity reveals that this is a work of Christian apologetics, not politics. Okay, it's important. Second, just as the soul is present in every part of the body, so Christians are present in every part of the world. No part of the body monopolizes the soul. The soul is equally present in all its intensity to each part of the body. Just so, Christians are equally present in each city because they do not belong to the world. They belong to an invisible order as the soul is distinct from and transcends the body. And third, just as the body hates the soul for not indulging its pleasures, the world hates Christians because their very presence is a prophetic sign that the world's deeds are evil. And here lies the most important clue as to the author's understanding of the image of soul-body. Most scholars agree that this anonymous author was a Stoic convert to Christianity. That was not uncommon. Many early Christians took influence from Stoic philosophy. Thus, the image of soul-body is one where the soul is, quote, imprisoned in the body. This is not Aristotelian Thomistic hylomorphism. Certainly, this is not the anthropology that the church has come to accept as a realistic anthropology. In Aristotelian anthropology, the soul is the substantial form of the body, the principle that makes the body to be the body at all. Soul and body are not two things accidentally tied together, one suffering imprisonment in the other. No, but two principles, form and matter, that together constitute one composite being, one thing, possessing the act of being. The body is for the soul, and the soul loves the body, and the body loves the soul. But not so for the author of this letter. For the author of the letter, the body is hostile to the soul. Quote, he says, the soul lives in the body, but it does not belong to the body. This is clearly Stoic anthropology. But however false his metaphysics may be, it is central as an interpretive key for the use of this image of soul-body. Why? The author uses this image of soul to body not to stress the unity of the church with the world, but rather its otherness. That's the key. He likens Christians to world as soul to body, not to highlight their unity, but just the reverse. He's doing the opposite. The church, according to him, is in the world, but forever distinct from the world. That's the meaning of the image. Christianity, for this author, does not offer one more natural religion. The God of the Christians, our Lord Jesus Christ, is not one additional God in the pantheon of gods who happens to rank above the rest. It's not our Lord. Jesus is the one Lord to whom every knee shall bow. The Christian religion, therefore, does not relate to the city as pagan gods relate to the pagan city. It's not. Christianity is not just one more pagan religion. Christians can be in every city, he says, actually in the first part, in the first paragraph, paragraph 5. Christians can be in every city. They speak any language. They follow any native custom of clothing and food. The author writes, this is in the first paragraph on the handout, they dwell in their own countries, but simply as sojourners. As citizens, they share in all things with others and yet endure all things as if foreigners. Every foreign land is to them their own native country, and every land of their birth as a land of strangers. Wow. But here's the deal. Here's the deal for the author of this letter. Precisely because Christians belong to a transcendent supernatural society, they will be better citizens. That's the whole point. Not because they're irreligious, but precisely because they worship the real God, the God with the true power to save. The deal is this. Give the Christian church the complete freedom and autonomy to exercise her saving mission, and she will give you your best citizens. Better citizens than all who worship false gods. And because they belong to a supernatural church, Christians in the world will have a purifying and indeed a sanctifying effect on the temporal order. But words change. Metaphors change. In this first ancient appearance of the soul-body metaphor carries a meaning almost exactly the opposite of how it would later be used. Part two. Is everybody with me? Images are powerful things. Images are very powerful. Their hold on the imagination often outlasts the changing meaning of the words beneath them. The ancient world changed. After Constantine's conversion, the empire underwent a slow, centuries-long conversion to the Christian faith. The ascendancy of the church to officially sanction state religion completely reshaped the relation of Christians to the apparatus of the state. And thus, the soul-body metaphor, once used to express the church's dignified transcendence, would soon be used to forge her bond with the temporal state. The first hint of this transition appears in the famous letter of Pope Galesius I, a letter to Emperor Anastasius. This is 494. This is actually one of my favorite documents from the early church. The context is the first growing pains between the authority of the church and the authority of the temporal rulers of Rome, now themselves professed Christians, which is very new, very new. Simply put, who governs who? Who has the last word? It's a big question. It's a big question. Courageously, and no doubt at great personal risk, Pope Galesius insists on the church's transcendent authority over all temporal power. The Christian emperor must submit to the church. For the sake of time, I won't read the entire quote. But he writes, "Indeed, there are two means, August Emperor, by which this world is chiefly ruled, the sacred authority, the auctoritas sacrata, of the priests, and the royal power." And basically he says, of these, how much greater is the responsibility of priests? So you have priestly power, priestly authority, priestly power. Basically, he says to the emperor, your authority doesn't trump that of the priestly power. You are subject. You, a temporal ruler, are subject to the spiritual power. Courageous, no doubt. But notice the shift that starts to occur in the Pope's language. He does not describe Christians, especially if you read the entire letter, through the biblical formula of in the world but not of it. But he begins to describe the church as in and, in a way, connected to the world. The church is not described in terms of Christians composing it, but rather in terms of her power, in terms of authority, which is unique. It's a unique shift. It becomes a priestly power. It's a power within the world, alongside the temporal power as a regalis potestas to govern it. The image animating his mind is one single society, this world, ruled by two means, the temporal authority and the spiritual. And this shift is key, as we will soon see. Here, too, the Pope introduces the image of the two swords. This image, too, and the Pope, along with St. Augustine's famous work, the image of the two swords, one temporal, one spiritual, which would become a defining image for church-state relations for centuries to come. Image of two swords. Moving forward a few centuries, St. Thomas Aquinas, thinker, of course, of whom I pay great allegiance, also uses the soul-body metaphor. He uses it only once in his Summa Theologiae. Only once, of course, to speak of two powers, temporal and spiritual. In his teaching on just judgment, this is in his Secunda Secundae, his just judgment, he argues against all usurpation of judgment and of authority. This is important. Since it belongs to the same power to interpret and to make laws, he puts on the lips of a third objector, one of his third objectors, the fact that ecclesial prelates have sometimes done precisely this. Ecclesial prelates have usurped authority. They've usurped the judgment of temporal authorities. The objector claims, spiritual power is distinct from the temporal. Now, prelates having spiritual power sometimes interfere in matters concerning the secular power. Therefore, usurped judgment is not unlawful. Aquinas responds, the secular power is subject to the spiritual, even as the body is subject to the soul. Consequently, the judgment is not usurped if the spiritual authority interferes in those temporal matters that are subject to the spiritual authority or which have been committed to the spiritual by the temporal authority. St. Thomas then uses the same image. But his use of the image, though quite distinct from the author to the letter to Diognetus, accomplishes two very similar objectives. First, spiritual prelates are a true power that exercise real public authority. Second, it is the transcendent authority. It is a transcendent authority. The authority of priests are a transcendent authority, not subject to the temporal, but are above it, just as the soul is above the body. St. Thomas himself does not philosophically unpack the metaphor. He simply adopts it from the tradition to assert the church's superiority over temporal rulers. Moving forward again, the soul-body metaphor, along with the two swords image, reaches a type of apotheosis in the work of one of St. Thomas's students, Aegidius Romanus, or Giles of Rome. Like St. Thomas, Giles adopts the image, but unlike St. Thomas, he leans into the image as expressing a hylomorphic unity that now extends all the way to church and state. In his De Ecclesiastica Potestate, he writes, I'll go ahead and read the whole quote. We got plenty of time. For just as body, since it is body, exists for the sake of the soul and is subordinated to the soul, so all things earthly and temporal are as such subordinated to spiritual things and as of right must be subject to them. From which obligation we have noted above, they can never be released. Earthly princes then, since they are such, and since they possess the material sword, must be subject to the spiritual power, and especially the power of the Supreme Pontiff. They cannot rid themselves of this obligation or yoke. But this yoke is not servitude, but liberty, for the yoke of Christ is pleasant and his burden is light. And so if earthly princes, as possessing the material sword, are subject to the church, then since anyone to whom a thing is subject is said to possess it as commander, for if he does not possess it as commander, it is not subject to him, it is well said that the church possesses the material sword as commander, even though not its user. That's a radical shift. So here, like all before him, Giles stresses the superior nature of the church over the temporal authority, but he puts the image of soul-body to work in a very different way. It accomplishes a completely different task from what it accomplished in the second century. Rather than highlighting the transcendence of spiritual over temporal power, Giles forges a unity between them so complete that the church simply is the temporal power. The church is the temporal power. All others who exercise temporal rule only do so at her command, as the body is commanded by the soul. He has smuggled into the soul-body image a hylomorphic unity unseen in its first instance. Whereas for the patristic author, the body hates the soul. For Giles, the body loves it. Since soul and body now form one single thing, any temporal power exercised anywhere is essentially the power of the church as its formal principle. The two swords belong essentially to the church as the one real quiddity or whatness of society. For Giles, the church and state form one thing, one single society, one unity. The state is merely the material apparatus the church may use to govern. Reading Giles in full, it becomes clear that the church doesn't even really need the temporal state for Giles. The church simply is the state. The only reason he gives for a distinct power by laymen, is the necessity of what he calls the jus sanguinis. The jus sanguinis, or the right of blood. The power to basically execute criminals, capital punishment. Since it is unfitting for priests to shed blood, so Giles' reasoning goes, since it's unfit for priests to shed blood, there needs to be a temporal power given to laymen to exercise the jus sanguinis. But if it wasn't for the jus sanguinis, which is necessary to keep temporal order, for Giles, there really doesn't even need to be a temporal power because it's essentially the church. So in a certain sense, the image has done a 180. The same metaphor serves an entirely different purpose in a different age. Now, like most extreme positions, Giles's view had an appeal of simplicity, very attractive to those more inclined to use church authority as a bludgeon against her enemies than to perhaps think carefully about it. And as a result, his conclusions gained traction after the spiritual upheaval of the 16th century Protestant revolt. I don't want to call it a reformation, because it was not. The revolt, which denied all papal authority whatsoever, spiritual or temporal. I'm sorry if we have any Protestants in the room. Do we have Protestants? I apologize. I used to be Protestant, by the way. I'm a Catholic convert myself. So, huh? What was that?
That's going to happen again.
What's going to happen again? Oh, I know, of course it will. Yes. In the midst of this polarization after the Protestant revolt, God gave us a brilliant synthesizer in a doctor of the church, St. Robert Bellarmine. Bellarmine had a tightrope to walk. His task was to defend papal power against those who denied it altogether, while also rebuking what he called the, quote, integrists of his day, particularly Alexander Carrarius of his own day. He wrote a letter against Alexander Carrarius for what he called the simplicity of their views. I don't have this quote on the handout, but I'll go ahead and read it. Speaking of Alexander Carrarius, he says this. This is Robert Bellarmine. Since he does not discuss the manner in which the popes possess this temporal power, those that are basically following the opinion of Giles of Rome, and thus ignores the state of the question, all the arguments of Carrarius and authors like him are idle. Not only are they of no help to the ecclesiastical power, but they are even disastrous to it, since without reason they make it odious to the princes of this world. So Bellarmine calls this kind of echo of Giles of Rome, this kind of simple, like absolute, hylomorphic unity, a type of simplicity that makes the church odious. For the sake of time, I'm not going to read all of Giles's quotes, or not Giles, but Bellarmine's quotes. I have a lot of Bellarmine quotes on the page, actually. I'll just simply summarize. Unlike Giles, Bellarmine recognized the state's legitimate power as genuinely belonging to it. He recognized this legitimate power. And yet, to defend the Pope against the Protestant rejection of the office of papacy altogether, he upholds the Pope's supreme spiritual power. The Pope's jurisdiction is principally spiritual, over all things pertaining to the salvation of souls. But insofar as temporal affairs touch on the spiritual, the Pope's jurisdiction extends to them as a secondary object or indirectly. This is Bellarmine's famous indirect theory, theory of indirect powers. There is, therefore, no usurpation of authority when the Pope intervenes in temporal affairs. Where the temporal bears upon the spiritual, the Pope has a right to act. But he does not deny the legitimate ontology of temporal authority. He doesn't, just like the classical thinkers, he recognized the city as having its own natural intelligibility and authority before grace, outside the church. You know, like basically, the city existed before the church. This is what. So now Bellarmine cannot be praised enough for the synthesis he accomplished. And in his thought, we see the very beginnings of a shift back. That is, a shift towards the vision of the church as a spiritual power distinct from temporal power, wherein both possess a natural intelligibility defined by their distinct natural ends. The church is within the world, but not of it. Yet for all his achievements, Bellarmine was still working within the frame of his predecessors, reacting to them, speaking their language, forging a middle path between two extremes that the politics of his day provided. Questions still remained. Thus, a deeper, more comprehensive reflection on the nature of the church and her relation to the world was still needed. And finally, this is the last in this section. The image of soul-body sounds one more time in Pope Leo XIII. History will immortalize this pope as inaugurating Catholic social teaching, his great encyclical Rerum Novarum of 1891. However, Pope Leo's pre-Rerum encyclicals must not be forgotten. Oftentimes they're overlooked, and they're absolutely marvelous. Pope Leo XIII's, the pre-Rerum encyclicals are absolutely marvelous. And in them, he sows the seed of what would later flower as modern Catholic social teaching. So all the seeds are here. In 1885, he employs the soul-body image. He does so only once in his voluminous writings, and he never really employs it again. He uses it once, and he never employs it again. There's great development over his own thought between 1885 and certainly 1900. So it's important. He kind of plucks this image from the tradition. He uses it as it had been used. But as we see in Leo's writings, if I wish I had a time to do a 3-hour lecture just on Leo's writings and stuff, there's great even development in Leo himself. In his 1885 encyclical Immortale Dei, Pope Leo XIII states, "There must accordingly exist between these two powers," again, powers, ecclesial and civil, "a certain orderly connection, which may be compared to the union of soul and body and man." Thus, he simply pulls the image from the tradition and employs it in a familiar way. This would have arrested the attention of no one in his day. Yet he then adds, it's the same paragraph, this is just continuing, "The nature and scope of that connection can be determined only by having regard to the nature of each power and by taking account of the relative excellence and nobleness of their purpose. One of the two has for its proximate and chief object the well-being of this mortal life. The other, the everlasting joys of heaven. Whatever, therefore, in things human is of a sacred character, whatever belongs either of its own nature or by reason of the end to which it is referred to the salvation of souls or to the worship of God, is the subject to the power and judgment of the church. Whatever is to be ranged under the civil and political order is rightly subject to the civil authority. Jesus Christ has himself given the command that what is Caesar's is to be rendered to Caesar, and that which belongs to God is to be rendered to God." This is remarkable, actually. Like those before him, Leo uses the soul-body image, and he uses the language of two powers. But he makes one decisive move previous thinkers did not make. He leans into the language of two distinct powers ordered to two distinct objects and ends. One of the two has for its proximate and chief object, quote, the well-being of this mortal life, he says, and, quote, the other, the everlasting joys of heaven. And to make no mistake of his intent, he follows with the biblical formula, render to Caesar what is Caesar's, and render to God what is God's. And this leads us to the advent of Catholic social teaching. Part three. I have a few minutes left. Forgive me, I know this is long. Is everybody with me? Catholic social teaching. When Pope Leo XIII published Rerum Novarum in 1891, he began a tradition of thought that Pope Pius XI finally coined Catholic social teaching. But what is Catholic social teaching? First of all, it is not Catholic politics. Definitely, if I see people writing things down, put this in your notes. Catholic social teaching is not Catholic politics. It is also not Catholic social action. God bless. It's not Catholic social action, okay? Rather, it is a disciplined and nuanced reflection on the nature of human society and man's nature as a social animal. This means that it is fundamentally a theology. It's fundamentally theology. And interestingly, as a theological reflection on society, the image of two swords drops out completely in the 20th century. The image of two swords goes away. The church no longer describes herself as a sword. Also, the language of the church as one of two powers goes away. It just goes away. And in their place, the popes begin to speak of both the church and the temporal polity as distinct, complete societies. A society. If you want to read a masterful work, Pope Pius XII, Mystici Corporis Christi, is an absolute masterpiece. And in this encyclical on the church, in 1951, there's so much deep social ontology, like deep metaphysics about the nature of society. In an encyclical on the church, it's absolutely marvelous. But people underestimate what a radical development this is, church thought, and a deepening of the church's reflection on her own self. It's a masterpiece. But let's go on. In his 1929 encyclical, Divini Ilius Magistri, Pope Pius XI states clearly, this is paragraph 11 from Divini Ilius Magistri. Now there are three necessary societies, distinct from one another and yet harmoniously combined by God, into which man is born. Two, namely the family and civil society, belong to the natural order. And the third, the church, to the supernatural order. Three necessary societies. Three. The church, the polity, and the family. This is why for the first time in church history, since the advent of Catholic social teaching, you have encyclicals on what? You have actually encyclicals on ecclesiology, and you have encyclicals on the family. Whereas these are societies. So people think of just the encyclicals on politics as being social encyclicals. That's a radical truncation of what Catholic social teaching is. The encyclicals on the family are social teaching. It's part of society. The family is a society. All three, family, polity, and church, are distinct societies, each with their own origin, order, and end. The family and the polity belong to the natural order, the church to the supernatural. And stressing his allegiance to classical social ontology, Pope Pius XI notes that the family, he does this later on, I think it's in paragraph 12, it's on the list, the family is an imperfect society. That follows Aristotle. It's exactly what Aristotle says. The family is an imperfect society. The polity and the church are perfect societies. Perfect or complete societies. Pius says of the church, the third society into which man is born, when through baptism he reaches the divine life of grace, is the church, a society of the supernatural order and of universal extent, a perfect society because it has in itself all the means required for its own end, which is the eternal salvation of mankind. Hence it is supernatural in its own, hence it is supreme in its own domain. Now, stressing the complete perfection of the church in the supernatural order is only an echo of Pope Leo XIII itself. Pope Leo XIII says, I believe this is a quote from Christiane Sapientiae, isn't it right? Christiane Sapientiae, this is 1890. It cannot be doubted, under safeguard of the faith, that the governance of souls was committed to the church alone, and such wise the powers of the political order have no share in it whatsoever. The church alone has the monopoly on grace. Period. The state was not founded by our Lord. The church was founded by our Lord. It alone has the power to give grace. Game, set, match. Period. Or else we're back at paganism. What does this suggest to us about the image of church and state that began to animate the minds of the holy popes as they reflected on human society? I would suggest this. The image in their mind is not one where the church and state together form one thing. That's a mistake. One essential society with two powers. Nope. The church is not just a power within society. That's not what the church is. The church is not just a sword within society. No. For the popes, the church is not just a power or some spiritual sword that we're swinging around. Instead, the image in their mind is one where the church and the polity are two distinct societies, each perfect within its own order, with its own object and end. Now, how does this change our image? First, we must note that the image of soul-body has not gone away. The image of swords has gone away in the contemporary church. The image of power, the church being just a power, has gone away. But not the image of using soul and body hasn't gone away. It still exists, and it's very strong. But it has been distilled back to a purified form. This purified vision carries a remarkable historical echo. In his address to the Korean bishops, John Paul II encourages them to inspire all Christians to take an active role in public life, to bring the kingdom into the world, to purify the world. This is on the handout, John Paul II's quote. The Pope speaks of the church as a leaven and a kind of soul for human society, a soul. But this phrase, a leaven and a soul of human society, is not original to John Paul II. He is citing Gaudium et Spes 40, which also describes the church as a leaven and a kind of soul of society. And here, Gaudium et Spes is simply citing Lumen Gentium 38, which also speaks of each Christian's duty to stand before the world as a witness to the resurrection and life of our Lord Jesus. And in this passage, in Lumen Gentium 38, he claims, or the Council Fathers claim, that Christians must be to the world what the soul is to the body. That's in Lumen Gentium 38, and that is a citation of the letter to Diognetus. The letter to Diognetus. The ancient apologist image, first developed in the second century to defend a persecuted community, has traveled through the entire tradition, through Gelasius and Aquinas, through Giles and Bellarmine, Leo XIII, and it's arrived, purified, at the heart of the church's most authoritative modern self-description, a type of going out and returning. But this leads to another question. Oh man, I never have enough time. Does the polity have a soul? Does society have a soul? And if so, what? Does society have a soul? A polity is a society. And I specifically use the word polity and not another word that I don't like, actually. I think it's a better word. The state. That's just the material apparatus that the polity uses to organize itself. That's very different than the polity, which is a society. Cool? It's a multitude unified by common actions towards a common end. As mentioned in part one, it's animated by justice as the society's binding force. As a whole of order, it is not a substance. So society is not the kind of thing that has a substantial form. I shouldn't have to really explain that one. That should be easy. Nor is it a mere collection of individuals accidentally sharing some place. The unity of a polity, then, is stronger than a collection, but weaker than that of a substantial form of a human person. If the state has something like a soul, then it cannot be a substantial form. It must be something else that unifies society into one. As a whole of order, the only thing that could unify disparate parts into one is a common end. That common end is the common good. The common good. The soul of the polity, the soul of the state, is the common good. The common good. Now, what is a common good? A common good, as Augustine understood it, is one that is good precisely because it is shared. It is not diminished by participation, but only intensifies by participation. It is not a public utility consumed in common. Such goods only diminish when being used. A true common good is shareable by all and extends its goodness to all and each of its parts at once. What then is the common good that functions as the soul of society? It is the intrinsic whole of order of all the parts of society living as one, the good of human persons living together in justice and virtue, order towards their full natural flourishing, which, as the popes would insist, would not even be possible without the supernatural society of the church. The common good is the shared good, which is not diminished when many participate in it, but is actually increased and intensified by that participation. It belongs in its fullness to no single member of the community, and yet it belongs in its entirety to each one. It is the good of the whole that is simultaneously the good of each part. Now we can see why the soul-body metaphor, when applied to church and state, had to be purified. Giles's error was one of conflation. By pressing the hylomorphic image until church and state collapse into one thing, he swallowed the supernatural order into the natural, merging two distinct common goods and common ends. But there are two ends. There are two at stake: the temporal common good of the political order, and ordered to peace, justice, and natural flourishing, and the supernatural common good of the church, which is what? Eternal beatitude, the vision of God, the face-to-face vision of God. These are not two versions of the same good. This is very important. These are not two versions of one and the same good. Then we're back in paganism. To confuse them, to make the church the formal principle of the state, does not elevate the state. It obscures the church, reducing her supernatural mission to a species of political governance. To conflate the two is not first a political error, it's first an ecclesiological error. This is why Joseph Ratzinger, in his masterful book, Faith in Politics, I have it here, it's a masterful book, wrote it in the 90s, quote, "By merging with the state, the church would destroy both the essence of the state and her own essence. The church remains something outside the state, for only thus can both church and state be what they are meant to be. Like the state, the church too must remain in her own proper place and within her boundaries. She must respect her own being and her own freedom, precisely in order to perform for the state the service that the latter requires." Very important. This is where Leo XIII's genuine contribution lies. Though he still uses the soul-body image in Immortali Dei, notice what he does with it. He speaks of two powers ordered to two distinct ends. One, the well-being of this mortal life, the other, the joys of heaven. Two ends, two societies. And that's an echo all throughout Catholic social teaching. Each with its own common good, its own proper authority. For Leo, the Church is not the formal principle of the state. She is a distinct and perfect society, a societas perfecta, established not by nature, but by grace. Endowed by her founder with all the means necessary to lead her members to the supernatural end of heaven. She has her own laws, her own courts, her own governing authority. She is no department of the state, and the state is no department of her. They are two perfect societies, each ordered to the good of the other and to the good that the other cannot provide. The polity cannot provide grace. Cannot. This distinction, and it is a crucial one, is not a concession to the secular world. It is a theological achievement. It recovers the original intention of the fathers of the Church. The Church is in the world, but not of it. Not because the Church is indifferent to the world, but because she belongs to a different order of reality altogether. She does not abandon the world. She does not despise the world, but she does not belong to it. And it is precisely this, her belonging to another order, that gives her presence in the world its transforming power. That's the whole point. She is a leaven. She's not lumber. She works from within, not by domination from above. And here we encounter a remarkable insight from Joseph Ratzinger. Again, this is Joseph Ratzinger, but this is from his second volume of Jesus of Nazareth. Second volume. Jesus has actually achieved a separation of religion from politics. Remember, he understands the ancient world. Joseph Ratzinger understood that the union of politics and religion is the human norm in the pagan world. That's normal. Until grace comes. Now everything's different. Jesus has actually achieved a separation of the religion from the political, thereby changing the world. This is what truly marks the essence of his new path. This brings us back to the question of the interweaving and the separation of religion and politics. In his teaching and in his whole ministry, Jesus had inaugurated a non-political messianic kingdom and had begun to detach these two hitherto inseparable realities from one another. This is an extraordinary claim by Ratzinger, and it should stop us in our tracks. The distinction between the Church and politics, properly understood, is not a modern invention. It is not a concession wrested from a weakened Church by Enlightenment philosophers, nor revolutionary politicians. Also, separation of Church and state nowadays is just a tool for statecraft. It's just a tool for secular statecraft to free the secular society from any kind of adherence to the natural law. Which is a complete corruption. It's a complete corruption. It is Ratzinger, as Ratzinger insists, inaugurated by our Lord himself. It was Jesus who told Pilate plainly, "My kingdom is not of this world." The very act of founding a church that is distinct from the state, a society ordered to a supernatural end, was a revolution in the history of human civilization. It broke open an ancient fusion of religion and politics that held every pagan city bound. The world has never been the same. But, and I promise you this is towards the end. I know I'm holding you guys hostage right now. I promise you this is the end. If the Church is distinct and a perfect society ordered to a supernatural end, what concretely is her relationship to the temporal order? How does she act within the world to which she does not belong? Here, John Paul II offers a vision that is at once clarifying and, I think, deeply exacting. Again, in his address to the Korean bishops, he writes that Christians are to assume their specific role in the transformation of the temporal order, in the perspective of God's kingdom by promoting human dignity, building solidarity, and serving the common good. That's a quote from him. The lay faithful are not to be passive within the temporal order. They are the ones who carry the church's supernatural vitality into the offices, the courtrooms, the universities, legislators, family and neighborhoods, and ultimately to the world. The church does not govern the state, but she forms persons who do. She does not wield a temporal sword, but she forms the conscience of those who must decide when and whether to wield it. She doesn't write secular laws, but she raises the men and women whose sense of justice will insist that those laws be just. This is not a diminished version of the church's role in public life. It is actually a more difficult one. It demands not that the church seize power, but that she produce saints, men and women so formed in truth and charity that their very presence in the world becomes a transformative force. It demands that the church take seriously her own supernatural identity, her own sacramental life, her own tradition of moral and intellectual formation, and trust that this, and not political domination, is the instrument by which God intends to renew the face of the earth. So we come full circle. We began with a second century apologist writing under persecution, defending a strange and otherworldly community to a skeptical Roman audience. His argument was simple. Christians are no threat to the city. They are, in fact, your city's best hope, not because they rule it, not because they command a sword, but because they belong to a transcendent society. And precisely for that reason, they are most faithful and most just and most genuinely civic of all citizens. 2,000 years later, the church has not changed her nature. She is still that community of persons called out of the world, formed by grace, nourished by the sacraments, ordered to the vision of God. And in this, we must return not to the image of the founders of the church, but actually to the biblical image itself, the biblical image that the church is not soul in the world. The church is salt of the world. Salt, not soul. The church relates to the world not as soul to body, but as grace relates to the soul. Grace to the soul. That's the image. Her relationship to the state is one of grace-filled leaven to a world that needs it. Present to it, distinct from it, not imprisoned by it, not dissolved into it, and ultimately, not overcome by it. My kingdom, our Lord says, is not of this world. It never was. And therein, my friends, lies its true power. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.